Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michael Gibbons, Chief Judge, appearing in Carson City. I'm joined by Judges Jerry Tao and Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. Can you hear me all right? All right. Mr. Mills, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Justice.
All right. Judge Tao, you want to speak? Make sure they can hear you.
Yeah, can everybody hear us down here in Vegas?
Yes.
Can you all nod or something? Okay.
Hopefully you can hear me as well.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, welcome. This is a continuation of our oral argument calendar this afternoon. The last one went fine, no technical problems. If there is a technical problem, we will just stop and to try to correct it. If worse comes to worse, we would get you on the phone. We've only had that happen once, fortunately. We started doing these oral arguments by video in May. We're looking at this coming May going back to real life. We hope that happens. I know everyone appearing in family court has had varying experiences in terms of personal appearance versus video. It's very difficult. I know the civil criminal is trying to open up as much as possible to the in-person, and the family court seems to me it's going by department and not the court as a whole, at least from what I've heard. But nonetheless, this case isn't affected by that issue, and we're happy you can appear today through the audio-visual method. Interestingly enough, that's one of the issues in this case. Judge Tao, do you have any opening comments?
No, just to thank all of you for working with us and appearing this way. You know, oral arguments this way are never ideal, but it's the best we can do. And I know it's more difficult for everybody in terms of, you know, not only the video and the audio of what we're doing now, but I know you had to call in, do like a trial run with our IT guys and all that kind of stuff. And it probably was a little distracting, but it's, you know, it's what we need to do. And we appreciate everybody working with us during this time, but it's all we can do. It's either this or not have oral arguments at all. And we'd rather not do that. So thank you all for working with us. And we're just trying to muddle through the next few months, hopefully. And then we can get back to having, you know, real in-person arguments.
Judge Bulla.
Welcome. Thank you all so much for being here. As you can see, Judge Tao and I are both in our masks. So hopefully you will be able to hear us without a problem. If you do not understand a question or are having difficulty, please let us know. Thank you so much for being here.
And on behalf of all three of us, I want to apologize in advance. If we start asking a question while you guys are talking, we're not planning on interrupting you, but you know, sometimes there's the lag time and the whole we lose body language. So if I step on one of your sentences or start speaking before you guys are done, I want to apologize in advance. It's nothing personal. It's just a function of the era we're living in now. And but we're looking forward to the argument.
All right. So I'll officially call the case then. This is number 80548, Court of Appeals, Byrd versus Byrd. It's the time set for the oral argument. And we have the appellant, Mr. Byrd, represented by Mr. Mills. And we have the respondent, Ms. Byrd, represented by Ms. Lambertson and Ms. Webster. Who's going to be making the respondent's argument, or are you going to divide it?
Ms. Lambertson is.
Yeah.
All right, so Ms. Lambertson, you're going to make the full argument?
Yes, I had my mute off. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Your screen is freezing a little bit, so Ms. Webster, you might have to take over.
I hope not.
Yeah, just so you know, Ms. Lambertson, I think we can all hear you fine, but your picture is kind of freezing right now. The video is a little bit jumpy. Yeah, it's frozen right now, actually, but I think we can hear you okay.
Okay, I have my mute off. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you, but the picture is frozen now. I don't know what it looks like to you guys, but her picture's frozen on my screen, and now it's unfrozen.
All right. Well, if it turns out that we can't hear you, Ms. Lambertson, we will just pause and hope it comes on within a few seconds, and we'll let you know that we didn't hear you in case you were speaking and we missed something. And Ms. Webster, we won't force you to take over the argument, but you might have to add a little bit so we don't have to redo the argument.
Understood.
Okay. All right, Mr. Mills, do you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, please.
How much?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. All right. You're representing the appellant. You may proceed. One question we just want off the bat, just to let you know, to address this, because this case involved multiple judges, we want to make sure that which judge we're dealing with at which point in time on any particular ruling. So if you address a particular ruling, please state which judge that it was.
Your Honor, all of my arguments will be coming from the last trial, so the ruling made by Judge Hardcastle on October of 2019.
All right. And then also, if there are any orders to show cause that are addressed, you know, who issued the order or when was the OSC resolved, and if in fact there were any OSCs resolved at the October hearing that you're talking about.
Yeah, that is my understanding, is that's when the order to show cause was resolved, was at the October hearing.
All right, you may proceed with your 15 minutes, and we have the clock going there, and you'll see it yourself and when we get to three. All right, please proceed.
Thank you. Justices and court clerk, if it may please the court, my name is Gregor Mills, and I represent the appellant. The district court in this case made several matter of law errors. The first one I'll address deals with the conclusion of the court that the decree of divorce was vague or ambiguous. Now, the Nevada Supreme Court in Gallardi versus Naples held that a contract will not be, or is, sorry, vague and ambiguous if it has a double meaning. Not that it's the Supreme Court wasn't saying that two people couldn't disagree about a contract. It was more that the contract had words in it that had double meaning, or the contract itself, when you read it, had double meanings. In this case, the contract was clear and unambiguous. It stated no less than three times that Katarina was waiving her right to alimony. It was a short, concise statement. It doesn't have a double meaning. And now when you turn to the provision dealing with the house maintenance, that is straightforward too. $1,500 a month, as long as one of the three conditions aren't met. House is sold, the house is paid for, or her financial situation changes. Now, there is a statement in there that this is not a requirement. However, if the court were to find that somehow that phrase or that dealing with that was vague, then simply the court could just construe it or interpret it in an adverse light to my client, which that's what the judge Forsberg did, was saying that this is going to make it a requirement that he must pay $1,500 every month to her for a property for the house, and then unless one of those three things occur. You don't change it. The court should not have changed it to throwing it out the window and saying, well, we're going to make that alimony because it's vague and ambiguous. That is not what the court should have done, and the Supreme Court has made that clear. Same with the retirement. The retirement said that she got 50% of his United States retirement as long as he lived. Now, he had been retired for quite some time. And he had, back in 2011, had changed his retirement, the majority, to disability because he became 100% disabled while serving in the military army. And so that wasn't vague or ambiguous. Anybody who reads it would understand she was entitled to 50% of his retirement. The court also erred.
Mr. Mills, just on that one point factually, was there any disclosure to her that he had a disability payment, that he changed it, that his retirement was not the way it was originally set up, and that it went to disability? So, I mean, certainly he can change it, but what did he ever disclose it?
That evidence hasn't been, he didn't appear at trial and there wasn't any evidence of that, nor was there any evidence, I believe, to the contrary, that there wasn't. So that wasn't presented to the court at any time.
So, Mr. Mills, let me ask you this question. Did the appellant decide to change his retirement plan to disability prior to the divorce decree being entered?
Yes, he did that in 2011. The decree and divorce was done in 2014. Okay. And so it wasn't one of... I'm sorry,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, it wasn't one of these bait and switch or snaps where we've seen in the U.S. Supreme Court cases that deal where somebody retires, the wife is getting 50%, and then 4 years later takes the cash out payment for disability, and then that individual is stuck harmless. Is stuck now only collecting 50% of whatever's left over. Those are cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court. Those are cases that have happened across the United States. But let me just continue on with that argument. If that were to happen, even in that case scenario, that happens and someone has spouse support, for example, then what the courts hypothetically could do, it's never been tested about it, but they could say, hey, when you guys agreed to an alimony award, this is how much she was receiving off of her share of retirement. That doesn't exist. Therefore, we look at her financial condition and this. But what the Supreme Court said you can't do, you can't say, well, he was receiving, let's say, $1,200 or $1,500 from retirement. We're now going to make an award of alimony of $1,500. That is real clear. You cannot do that. You cannot substitute someone's separate property and turn it into community property. The Supreme Court has made that absolutely clear. The question is whether or not, in this case, there was no alimony. So what the judge did is absolute violation of the Constitution, of the Nevada Supreme Court cases dealing with where you have that retirement and now you're moving it over and now creating alimony when none existed and it's dollar for dollar what existed. And that occurred in two places here. The house, there was no need to change that. The payment's $1,500 till one of the three requirements happened. The judge put that in with retirement and then saw the other $1,500 and came up with the $3,1100 number that never existed, which is now going to be paid from his disability. That is what the Supreme Court, that is what the Congress doesn't want. They do not want vets that for some reason creditors are able to come and take all of their disability, and they're left on the streets. Now, if they agree,
Mr. Mills, yeah. Let me just clarify. So your client initially paid $1,500 a month towards the mortgage,
yes,
and continued to pay that. And then what was your client paying in terms of the retirement policy?
He was giving her in addition just because they were living separate and he was doing it. Was another $1,500. So he had been paying for 4 years after the decree of divorce a total of $3,000, even though his commitment was only $1,500.
So why was he paying the extra $1,500?
He was paying the $1,500 because prior to this, there was a time period where they were separated, and he was giving her so much every month, and so that was just something he had gotten used to, and he was paying it. It, like I said, it wasn't something that was agreed upon. It's not in the document. And the decree doesn't mention this additional $1,500.
But it does mention 50% of his retirement, correct?
It does.
So what amount represented the 50% of the retirement?
$57. His retirement, $57. And because they were in the military more than 10 years, her retirement pay should have come directly from the military once they were divorced. So it can't be.
Why wasn't the total $3,057 that he was paying? Because didn't he just pay $3,000?
He just was paying her $3,000 every month from 2014 until September of 2018. He was required to pay her $1,500.
All right.
And that's the total amount he was required to pay based on your position.
Yes, the total requirement he was required to pay was $1,557.
Mr. Mills, on the first $1,500 related to the house, typically when people get divorced, they sell their house and go their separate ways. Was this a community property house?
Yes, it was purchased during the marriage. He gave her the house. It was purchased back in 2013. They bought it together, and so she was living in it. He was living out of country, but yes. It was a community property house that was awarded to her through the decree with that payment also going towards that.
What about the mortgage? Whose name was on the mortgage?
Your Honor, I can't recall.
Right, because that, you know, I mean, anybody doing family law cases would know you sell the house if both people are on the mortgage, because otherwise both people are obligated to pay it. So you either sell the house or you refinance.
Yeah, that's the key. In a lot of divorces, you either have a time period to refinance or you sell it. In this case, as long as she was going to remain in that house, he was paying for the, and not even remain it. He gave her the house and basically, in essence, was saying, I'll pay for that house. And it didn't require her to live in it. That wasn't part of the provisions. It's just once it got paid for or it was sold, or for financial circumstances.
Did any of those conditions ever occur?
No.
So he should keep paying on the $1,500, shouldn't he?
Yes, he should.
Okay. And you're saying the second $1,500, it was purely out of his good nature to help her out?
Yes. Yeah, he was paying that above and beyond what they had negotiated in the decree of divorce.
Okay. Can you clarify if on this show cause issue, if there was a show cause order pending before the hearing, and did it relate to the denial of the motion for him to appear by audiovisual equipment?
The gist of it was is that they wanted him to an order show cause why he wasn't making the payments that were ordered at the first hearing by Judge Hardcap. The spouse support, temporary spouse support, and the $1,500 wanted to know why. Also, the order show cause then got encompassed him. It was an order for him to show cause why he wasn't making the payments that he was required to pay.
Okay. So are you saying it was then pending?
It was pending, yes, Your Honor. It was pending at the time of trial in which he did not appear.
Okay. All right. Can you say in a nutshell, since you're almost out of time, why there's no alimony in this case and the district court characterization of alimony is incorrect?
The reason why there's no alimony in this case is that he received the house as part of it and was also going to receive that $1,500 that was tied to her separate, well, after the decree would be her separate property based on those that both parties agreed. They had been living apart. They had been separated. The negotiations took over 4 months. That's why they agreed there would be no alimony.
All right, thank you. You can reserve the rest of your time then for rebuttal, and we'll switch to the respondent now and through Ms. Lambertson.
Hi, Your Honors. Good afternoon. Jean Lambertson here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Wondered about those technical difficulties.
Just go ahead. You're freezing occasionally, but I think your voice is still coming through.
Okay. Thank you. Katarina Bird, the respondent, Your Honor, is asking that this court affirm the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order that were entered on January 23rd of 2020. There was no abuse of discretion or error of law. I would like to just take a moment. I know there's discussion regarding the order to show cause. That, Your Honors, is respondent's appendix. It is date stamp 0444. It is a notice of entry of the order to show cause for Brady Bird to appear on October 21 of 2019. This was issued by Judge Forsberg, actually, from the result of a May 22nd hearing in 2019 on Katarina Bird's emergency motion for contempt of court, because even at the May 22nd hearing with Judge Forsberg, Brady Bird was ordered to continue to make payments to Katarina Bird, which he failed to do. So I hope that, and then Judge Hardcastle did rule on this order to show cause at the evidentiary hearing that was held October 21 of 2019. I would like to talk about the situation in this case does involve an ambiguous decree of divorce. And Judge Hardcastle found that it was ambiguous because it's reasonably susceptible to different interpretations. She makes that comment in the transcript, appellant's appendix, bait stamp 643, starting on line 6. That Grady Bird will continue to pay Katarina A. Bird $1,500 extra month to assist with her mortgage if her financial situation changes, or if the home is sold or paid off, this may cease. This is not an alimony payment and is not required. Judge Hardcastle did deem during the evidentiary hearing that you have a periodic payment, which is monthly. You have a specific dollar amount, which is the $1,500, and that it can change if her financial conditions are improved or if the house is sold. That this actually mirrors alimony language. And then by tacking in a statement that this is not alimony and can terminate at any time, created a vagueness and ambiguity. You correctly determined that a vagueness or ambiguity must be interpreted against the drafter. And it was Mr. Grady Bird who was the drafter or had it drafted. And that is seen in the respondent's appendix. We have bait stamps 479, 482, 484, 486, and 491 and 489. And this is where Grady Bird.
Oh. Ms. Lambertson, can I?
You have a question, ma'am?
Yes, I'd like to interrupt you there because I've seen an inconsistency. If you look at both the marital settlement agreement and the decree of divorce, both of them clearly say that no spousal support is required. So then we get to this section that you're referring to that is alleged to be ambiguous. If you look at the decree of divorce on page 2, you'll see that the divorce decree is in numbered paragraphs 1 through 16, and under paragraph number 7, we have four sub-paragraphs or sentences that are added, numbered sentences. And before these sentences start, it has the phrase, I request the following statements be added to the papers. The statements that are added include this so-called ambiguous one, number 4. It appears that Ms. Bird is the one that requested that these four points be added because all four of those were written for her benefit, including the ambiguous one. So doesn't the district court have it backwards about the drafter's rule that this particular section is drafted at Ms. Bird's request and not Mr. Bird's request? So she's the one that has to explain the ambiguity and have the rule against her?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. If you look at the parties separated in 2008. Mr. Bird then went overseas, so that left her here in Las Vegas, Nevada. And they corresponded by email. And Mr. Bird is the one that said, I will find an online company that does divorces for cheap. I need the following information from you to complete the packet. I will send you the papers. I will send you the divorce papers to ensure you get everything I have said. I'm sending you the papers. You sign, or I will hire a lawyer and take you to court. I will, and it is in this where Grady Bird says, I will have the following statement entered on the divorce paper. So I do see where you're looking at that as it coming from and arising from Katarina Bird, Your Honor, but that's not how the flow of communications went. It came from Grady Bird telling her around February of 2014 that now's the time for a divorce. I have to file for bankruptcy. I could see your mask is off. Do you have a question?
Right. Yes. I certainly don't disagree with anything you've just said as to the big picture of how this all unfolded. I know the appellant objects to some of this as improper parole evidence, but let's assume for the moment that it can be considered. Nonetheless, despite everything you just said, the statement says, I request the following statements be added to the papers. The I is coming from Katarina, not from Grady. Isn't that correct?
That is true how it is read, but it was how he dictated to her how the language had to be put on there.
So
she did not choose that wording, Your Honor.
Well, you're saying he wrote these four numbered sentences then, not her?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. By looking at the correspondence between the parties, you can see that that is what he put in the correspondence, is what he was going to place. Respondents 0494, go to that. If Your Honor, if you see RA00494, it is an email from Grady Bird dated April 7 of 2014, and he says, I will have the following entered on the divorce statement. And so he is choosing the words for her. And this was typical, Your Honor, of their life. He was significantly more educated than her. He had many advanced degrees. He was the military member. He kind of dictated how the party's life functioned. And so he did do these things for her.
All right, let me interrupt. Judge Ball, let me just finish this one point and then I'll stop.
Of course.
All right, let's assume you're correct on this for the moment. How do you reconcile the statements that both in the marital settlement agreement and the decree, it says husband and wife agree that they shall not be required to pay spousal support? I mean, that's a very clear statement, as it was just argued by Mr. Mills. So you have a very clear statement, then you have this less clear statement that's added to this. Does that somehow create an ambiguity? And even if it does create an ambiguity, under the parole evidence rule, you can only provide evidence that provides meaning to this, not that contradicts or changes this.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the parole evidence rule does not bar evidence to show that there could be fraud or misrepresentation or something going on in these dealings. And what has been presented on her testimony is that all along he revealed to her or told her that his retirement pay at the time of divorce in 2014 was $3,017, and it says that her 50% share is $1,508. That's respondents appendix 484. And he would, this was false, Your Honor. The reason this was false is that he never provided documents revealing this numbers. What Mr. Mills talked about is at the time of divorce, his military retired pay was not $3,017. It was only $128. So he misled her into thinking that she was going to benefit from a military retirement pay. And so she did not have full knowledge of all the material facts to go and sign and agree to this waiver as in Friendly Irishman versus Ronow. So she can't waive something that is essential if she's being misled as to the dollar amount that she may receive. And even Mr. Mills mentions the retirement pay, I think he said, was $37. Half of 128 is 64. So it's unconscionable that after a 31-year marriage, she's going to be left with $64. Referring to the home, they had only purchased it in October of 2013, which Mr. Mills references, and then February 2014. So we've got 4 months later, he's telling her now is the time for divorce. I have to move on. I have to declare bankruptcy. So a home that was just purchased 4 months ago, Your Honors, had little to no equity in it. It is not as if she had some grand community property asset. And she needed the $3,000 a month that he was promising her to pay for her bills and her necessities. And that is where Judge Hardcastle looked at. We have NRS 125-150, Section 8. Alimony is described as specified periodic payments. NRS 125-150, Section 9, alimony is determined on the condition, the financial condition, and she had a financial condition in her FBF. Yes, Your Honor?
If you're starting your alimony determination at the beginning, certainly you're going to do all those things. Mr. Mills was arguing there was a set amount, so if nothing else, the worst case scenario for him is the court should have only imposed the set amount of $1,500 and not the amount that was actually imposed, and certainly should not have made it lifetime. So that's a change. That's not a clarification.
Your Honor, the court looked at the alimony waiver. She looked at FATOR. Now, granted, this is a New Jersey case, FATTORE. FATORE, FATTORE, out of New Jersey. But the alimony waiver was not a bar to consideration of a post-judgment award of alimony because she gave valuable consideration to waive that alimony, thinking about her future share in his military pension and the unforeseeable loss of this bargain for pension was a substantial permanent change in circumstances which invalidated the waiver. And we've seen Parker versus Green where this court has invalidated a waiver. If he had been honest and if he had told her that my pension, my military pension that I'm giving you 50% of, you're only going to get $64, that could have materially changed this. He had a fiduciary duties, Your Honor, to disclose to her. They lived miles apart. They did communicate by email, and he breached that fiduciary duty. And so it's unconscionable to look at a decree, as Mr. Bird is wanting you to, that after 31 years of marriage, where he's got $116,000 annually, largely tax-free income, that she's going to get $64. That is unconscionable. And that is where the court... Judge Hardcastle looked at that that this can be a remedy in law and in equity. And
well, Ms. Lambertson, can I interrupt you, please, and stop you for a minute? Because what is the legal basis for the judge to have reconsidered and made a different award? Because this is almost 5 years later.
Yes,
Your
Honor.
Are you relying on NRCP 60? And if so, how do you think you fall within those parameters? And if not, what are you relying on? Because I heard the word equity. So what are
yes,
you relying on?
Yes, we're looking at NRP, 60 as well as equity. If you look at 60, Your Honor, 60B6 grants relief from a judgment or order for any other reason and timing. Her timing was prompt because it was within a month of her cutting him off and fraud. There's no time limit for setting aside an order based on fraud, and he committed fraud upon her by misleading her.
Judge Gibbons, may I just ask one follow-up question, please?
Certainly. You asked a multi-part question there, so I think you should take it one point at a time.
Well, I think my other question then is 60B6 is a relatively new rule, and it's not one that Nevada has had before, but it really is an alternative. And if your basis for a change in the agreement is fraud, then wouldn't that be something that would have had to have been brought to the court's attention within, I believe it's 6 months?
There's two parts to your question, Your Honor. If I first may address the 60B6. Yes, it is new, and we do have a Nevada U.S. District Court case, Naylon, N-A-Y-L-O-N versus W-I-T-T-R-I-G, 2017, and it does give guidance. It does talk about specific acts of bad faith that cause complete frustration. And Grady did have specific acts of bad faith that caused frustration with the decree. He falsely claimed his military pension was worth $3,017. He was poor, had no assets, had to file bankruptcy, while receiving largely $116,000 annual tax-free income. Importantly, Your Honor, when he got mad and warned Katerina not to get an attorney and continued to promise to support her for life. And then he terminated his payments to her because he said, they're voluntary, I don't have to do anything. I mean, if you could wrap her head around, he has not given her a dime despite the order to show cause and orders to continue payments to her during the pendency of these. It's a 31-year marriage where he essentially left her destitute. So I believe looking at Naylon, we're looking at these acts. This is a 60B6 case. Looking at fraud, Your Honor, you asked about fraud and the time limit. Arguably, there's no time limit in setting aside an order for fraud upon the court. NC-DSH, Inc. versus Garner, G-A-R-N-E-R, 125 Nevada, 647. And such relief should be liberally construed. Fraud upon the court involves situations where the other parties kept away from the court. And this is precisely the intent that he had. If he threatened her not to get an attorney, he told her he got mad and she was fearful if she did go get an attorney that he would cut her off. And I have to say that is exactly what happened in September of 2018 when I reached out and we were trying to get documents to find out what are these benefits she has because she had no paperwork, and he got frustrated and terminated the payments. So she did not have her time in court. Her voice was not able to be heard because she feared that he would cut her off and leave her alone. So she was kept away from the court, Your Honor. She was kept away, and she was timely. As soon as he cut her off, she did come to court. He cut her off September 2018. She was in court in October of 2018, and so this was a timely event, Your Honor. She was trying to get help when she realized that he was acting in bad faith. These promises he made to her were he was not fulfilling, and she lost much from her decree. So there's no reason in fairness and justice that she should not be allowed to receive relief from this decree of divorce, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you. We're asking for it to be affirmed.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Lambertson. Mr. Mills, you have a couple minutes left. As you've heard that Ms. Lamberson's made an argument in equity and claiming fraud, and of course there's a marital settlement agreement that has all the normal disclaimers in it that suggests there is no fraud, she could have seen an attorney and all that, but is that essentially invalid when a person misrepresents what their financial circumstances are? And if you look at the respondent's brief on page 4 at the top, they have a list of all of the various forms of income that he was receiving according to his financial disclosure. Now, of course, that's 2019. That's not 2014. But nonetheless, you know, it looks like there's some kind of misrepresentation here about what his income was. I already asked you about the disability versus the retirement part of it, but you know, I mean, you've done lots of these cases. I mean, if all of this had been disclosed, it probably would have been a different situation at the beginning. Whether we can procedurally address it now is a different question, a hard question. But nonetheless, you know, it doesn't look good. It doesn't pass the smell test, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I agree. If this were to go to court or if they had counsel, obviously things would be different. And I'm not ignorant to that fact. The problem is that when you apply the law, he doesn't have a fiduciary duty. There wasn't fraud because he didn't have to tell her. Once you tell someone, the Nevada Supreme Court has held that once you inform someone your intent to seek a divorce, they're on notice that you're going to be at. It's not shocking that half the divorces down there are uncontested, but more importantly, that people make promises. Look, no matter what the child support is, I promise I'll never let my kids go without. Or, you're the mother of my children. You think I'm not going to take care of you? It doesn't need to be in writing. The list goes on and on and on. And it seems like, well, on my end, because I deal with them once they come to me, these uncontested divorces where they don't go get attorneys that request the information that then requires the person under oath to sign a financial affidavit, which then makes them have fiduciary duty, comes into play. They're wanting fraud where there was no fraud. That's like saying a used car salesman did fraud when he sold you the car. No, you have to look at the contract. We all know that, and that's the same with the decree. There's not equity court here. We don't go back 5 years. And it is full, it's, the rule is 6 months for fraud. It's 6 months. In this case, it's been 5 years, but more importantly, it had been almost a year from the time he had stopped paying and they filed a motion. They filed a motion to enforce, not a 60B. And it wasn't until way later, 10 months after into the game, that 60B was brought up. And now it's like, what's crazy, it's all been turned into alimony, which didn't exist. And as your honor pointed out, it's clear. It's not ambiguous. No alimony. Now, whether or not he disclosed his true income, well, I submit he didn't have an obligation to. Not fraud. If you don't request it and make a financial affidavit be formed and you sign a stipulated petition, there's nothing in there that says I fully disclosed. Now, if there were assets, then they come after for assets that weren't, dispensed. But not income. I mean, a lot of people aren't putting down their overtime. And so I understand the effects of how it looks, the windfall that he got by going through this, but her too, she didn't have to pay for a lawyer. And so I'd ask that you, anyways, thank you for the time.
Well, you could finish your last statement.
Ms.
Lamberson took 3 minutes to finish her last statement, so you can take a few seconds.
Well, it's just that it stated that it's the whole creating something that didn't exist, that now is going to attach to a disability, is exactly what the United States Supreme Court doesn't want or has ruled and struck down. And it's exactly what the Nevada statute and what we have. If two parties stipulate that a person's going to pay a certain amount that's going to, in alimony, that's going to be coming from a person's disability, that's one thing. But there's a reason why he said no alimony. And there's a reason why she should have had a lawyer. And there's a reason why she added, he didn't have that, I'll pay you $1,500 for the house. That was negotiated. And he owes that. And that should be paid. But not as a form of alimony. It doesn't say upon remarriage. It doesn't quit because of her living with somebody, a domestic relationship. It's just if her financial situation changed where she no longer... The house, he didn't need to pay the house. Anyways, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Well, this one final question. The marital settlement agreement is signed by her in Clark County and by him in the Philippines. So how does the counsel issue come into play here? We all wish everybody would go to counsel. This is what happens when people try to do it themselves or they go through divorce services. They get screwed up. Could she have had an attorney, Mr. Mills?
Oh, yes.
Did she have any money?
Yes.
Did she have any money, though, to actually get an attorney?
Well, he was paying her at that point $3,000 a month, but she could have applied for the pro bono project. They negotiated for over 4 months. They'd been separated for years. So to say that over those course of the years, she never went and spoke to an attorney to find out what she's entitled to, and there's no time crunch. She could have said, nope, take me to court. There's nothing, that's not a valid threat. Hey, if you don't agree, I'm going to take you to court. I mean,
let me stop you there. We do have the findings of the district court. So if we end up applying those findings, that's what we have. So that's what the facts are, unless this hearing has to be redone.
I apologize.
Yeah, no problem there. So, counsel, everybody's very strong advocates for your clients here. We much appreciate it. This wasn't a case that we had to set for argument, but you can probably guess why we did. I mean, these are some challenging, difficult issues, some unusual issues. The new NRCP 60B6, we've got federal law dealing with some of these benefits. It makes for a pretty tough case. And then procedurally, the whole thing about with changing from judge to judge to back to judge, it's a little convoluted, but that's, again, what the record is. So we'll have to sort that out. But I just want to really thank both of you. Great, great job and strong advocacy. Much appreciated by all of us. Judge Tao, do you have any concluding comments?
No, just to echo your comment, which is that, you know, we set this case for argument for a specific reason. It's kind of one of those convoluted cases. A lot is going on here. But the argument was really helpful. Everybody did a great job, and thanks again for doing it by Zoom. It's not ideal, but it's what we got, and it was a really interesting argument, and we're going to do the best we can. Thank you.
Judge Bola?
Yes, thank you all so much, and I hope you understand when we interrupted or talked over you, and I apologize for doing it on my end. But again, this is the best we can do right now. And the arguments were very helpful, and thank you both so much. Actually, I should say thank all three of you. Greatly appreciated.
Right. We were going to give Ms. Webster a chance to talk, and she didn't actually say anything. Do you have a concluding statement, Ms. Webster, too? All right. Just how about a goodbye? All right. Your microphone's off. All right, we'll be in recess.
Thank you.
Oh, all right, there it is. We'll be in recess.